Welcome to Holy Unhappiness, conversations about the expectations we have of what the life of faith will feel like. I'm your host, Amanda Held Opelt, author of the book Holy Unhappiness, God, Goodness, and the Myth of the Blessed Life. Each week, I'll be speaking with writers, pastors, artists, and friends about the myths we believe about the good life. Together, we'll reimagine what blessing can look like if we are willing to look beyond our culture's definition of happiness and success. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. I was on an extended hiatus from this podcast, as I usually am. But over the last week, all of us have borne witness to these devastating wildfires in Los Angeles. The images of homes lost and communities destroyed are flooding into our news feeds. And, you know, most of us in the U.S. know somebody who lives in L.A., or we visited there ourselves at some point. So these images are really powerful. Moreover, here in Western North Carolina, we continue to recover from the devastating flood back in September. Between 70,000 and 100,000 homes in our state alone were damaged or destroyed, and right now we're experiencing one of the worst winters we've had in years, with sub-zero wind chills and lots of snow, so people living in tents and campers and temporary shelters are suffering immensely. And so I guess I've just been thinking a lot about disasters. How we experience them up close and how we process them from afar. And this is a topic that is fairly familiar to me. Some of you know that in my past life, I worked in the humanitarian aid sector for about 10 years. And I always tell people I wasn't a proper aid worker. I really just served other aid workers and helped them process their difficult experiences that they had in the field and supported them practically and organizationally. But what that role, what that job did for me was expose me to the breadth and the depth of the suffering all over the world, the vast amount of need and loss that there is. And it made me ask a lot of questions about how we are to hold all of this. How are we to think of God and our faith in the midst of all this suffering? What is ours to do? What is our responsibility to our fellow global citizens? And so I wanted to just have a conversation about all of this. And the first person who came to mind as a conversation partner is my friend Josie Gwynn. Josie is the co-founder and CEO of the Resilience Resource. She's a mental health coach for the American Association for Christian Counselors and a spiritual and psychological first aid instructor. She has her master's degree in transformational leadership development from Bethel Seminary at Bethel University in Minnesota, and is a PhD researcher investigating the intersection of faith and resilience in community at the University of Edinburgh School of Divinity in Scotland. She's credentialed to provide support in grief following trauma, emotional and spiritual care in disasters, advanced critical incident care for individuals and groups. Prior to co-founding the Resilience Resource, Josie served as a firefighter for 6 years and spent 18 years in the equine therapy industry. In the last decade, she's deployed to over 20 countries as a humanitarian aid chaplain and crisis care provider and trainer. She's been involved in cross-cultural and international contexts for over 35 years, living and serving in over 30 countries across the globe. Josie, along with her husband, Scott, has trained, resourced, and provided care for personnel, leaders, and teams from a variety of humanitarian aid and development organizations, as well as firefighters and law enforcement, first responder chaplains, medical personnel, and military and special forces personnel from all four branches of the U.S. military. You can see why I thought of Josie, why I believe she will be an excellent conversation partner to discuss these very hard things. Please stay tuned. I think you're going to enjoy the conversation. Josie Gwynn, it is so nice to see you and to have this conversation with you.
Such a gift to be on with you today.
So as I was saying in the introduction, you and I have worked together in the past. We've worked kind of in the realm of disaster relief and disaster response and got to share some pretty sweet years working shoulder to shoulder. And I don't know, when this disaster in LA began to unfold and I saw how much it was impacting people and I saw kind of the just the effect it seemed to be having on the broader public, I thought, I just want to have a conversation with somebody that is thoughtful about these things, that has some experience in these things. And yours was the first name and face that popped into my mind. So thank you for just coming on such short notice. There's a time difference between you and I. You are now in the UK studying. So thank you so much for being willing to come on.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. And it's a privilege to talk about something that I'm really passionate about, which is support for individuals and communities experiencing crisis and building and developing resilience. And I know that you're a passionate advocate for that as well, and just kind of that holistic restorative piece. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah. So, Josie, the first question I want to ask you is based on your experience in humanitarian aid and disaster response and crisis care, could you tell us a little bit about what the people who have lost their homes in these fires in LA are feeling right now? What is maybe that immediate impact, the physical, emotional, and mental, and even spiritual impact initially?
You know, that's such a great question because we see certainly highlighted on the news different stories identifying impact, and it, you know, can range at least what's communicated in news stories from this level of gratitude that people are alive and kind of expressions of it's, you know, it's just stuff and you know, we're, our family's safe, our loved ones are safe, to really kind of overwhelm and shut down and really not knowing what to do with this experience and feeling that deep grief. And, you know, those are very valid and common reactions. And I think something that the news stories often miss is that paradoxical aspect of human experience and emotion, where we really can experience multiple things at the same time. So, yeah. You know, something that's really common for people is that experience of relief, grief, and guilt all mm-hmm. existing in the same space, you know, relief that maybe it wasn't worse for them or as bad as it was for their neighbors. Grief for what they have lost, maybe guilt that they didn't lose as much. You know, I've heard that several times expressed in people whose houses are still standing, but obviously they're still deeply impacted. So it can range again. And I think another thing that's really important to identify that people often experience but can't put a name to is disenfranchised grief. So that ability to identify and feel that sense of loss around stuff and recognize it's okay to grieve the loss of a home, to grieve the loss of memories, to grieve the future loss of community, kind of feeling mm-hmm. that impending sense that your community is never going to be the same. And disenfranchised grief is really that unacknowledged or maybe unvalidated by social norms grief. So we put grief in that category of death and loss of a loved one, but we experience grief at so many other levels, you know. So that holistic response is really important to identify. And we've got a list of kind of common body, mind, heart, and soul reactions and responses, you know, through the resources that we put out, including our field guide for survivor-centered care. But some physical ones might be sleep deprivation. People find it really hard to fall asleep racing thoughts, paired with, you know, absolute exhaustion, which you would think would come with sleep deprivation. But sometimes it's paired with a sense of adrenaline. Like, yeah. I can just keep going forever and ever and ever. And, you know, this almost sense of empowerment. Adrenaline does funny things to our system.
Right. I was going to ask you about that, a little bit of a sense of disaster high, almost. That's not a clinical term, but it's my term. But this sense of almost like, just the impact that the adrenaline has on your body, almost like you're watching your life unfold as if it's a movie reel. And you're watching yourself almost rise to this occasion. You're watching your neighbors rise to the occasion. You're seeing in some ways the best of humanity. And there's almost this elation, I think, that can come with realizing, oh, my life is more than my stuff. Like, I am so grateful. And look at how the community is coming together. But then, of course, that's running parallel to this complete disorientation, complete devastation. Yes, I appreciate that you have named that juxtaposition.
Well, and I mean, people often reference it as kind of this sense of surreal euphoria, and and then almost kind of self-criticize a bit because like, oh gosh, like why do I feel these things? I should be experiencing fill in the blank. And first of all, the shoulds should go away because whatever you're experiencing is a common reaction to a critical event. You know,
I've heard it, stop shoulding on yourself.
I think that's a great phrase. And, you know, I think recognizing that what comes up must come down or will come down. And when you have, you know, kind of operated at a certain length of time in that level of euphoria, there will be a crash coming. And there's ways that the people can mitigate that crash. And I think we'll talk a little bit later about what people can do. But that euphoria or that sense of adrenaline rush is very common and completely normal. Again, people kind of self-criticize their responses, but the reality is any response, any physiological, emotional, psychological, spiritual response is a common response to an abnormal experience. You've been thrust into something critical and overwhelming, and your body's going to respond in unique ways to you. And that's okay. It's okay to identify those things.
So, yeah. Yeah. I appreciate also that you named the grief of losing stuff, because there's, you know, you see a lot of people kind of the first thing they say is like, well, stuff can be replaced. And I'm so thankful to have, you know, my life, my family's life, my pets have survived. And all of that is true. Mm-hmm. And also, like, home, a house is not just a house. It is a home. Home is where we build our lives. Home is sacred space. Home is where we, you know, kind of weave these relational ties together with our loved ones, with our community. We have a hard time talking about the material world as actually mattering sometimes. A lot of times in faith circles, we have a hard time with that. But Western culture in general, I think kind of downplays the holiness and the importance of kind of our material lives and what they represent and what they, you know, what is embodied in the walls and the floors and the roof that kind of make our home, what it represents. And so to grieve the loss of sacred space, like a home, like a restaurant that you have a million memories at, when you lose so many homes in a neighborhood, what that means is that the community scatters. And so it's not just that, like, well, everyone lost their houses. It's like this fabric that we've all been weaving together as a community is becoming violently, you know, rent and torn apart. And where is everyone going to go? And the people that you rely most on, these community members that you've lived life alongside shoulder to shoulder, you go through the worst possible thing you can imagine together as a community, and you're scattered and you're displaced. Yep. And that is a traumatic rendering of community in many ways.
Mm-hmm. No, 100% agreed. We underestimate how much the holistic aspect of how we live our lives, body, mind, heart, and soul, and the emphasis here in this section of the conversation on the embodied part is intertwined with our identity. So when those things are torn out, I mean, it really is like losing a part of yourself that has to be recreated, because you have entered into this space that has informed who you are, and you are informing what the space is. And so whether that's your your house, whether that's, you know, some people have just lost part of their homes, or they've just lost some aspects of stuff, but not the entirety of their home. The reality is they're facing that this component of change, that things are never going to be the same. And so part of that loss is even a grieving of what someone had hoped would be, but now is never going to be possible. And that can be just as impactful as a physical wound. Mm. Again, we underestimate the impact of these kinds of events at a psychological and emotional level. And we keep kind of trying to separate and compartmentalize these physical, emotional, psychological, spiritual pieces, but it's all integrated. Mm. And when these, we talk a lot in our work about kind of these four foundational relationships that are necessary for really holistic resilience, holistic thriving. And one of those is a relationship with community. The other is a relationship with self. And those are so reciprocally integrated that when you render one from the other, there really is a re-identifying that's necessary. Who are yeah. you in this different space? Right. And what is this new space that you're entering into going to look like because you've now entered into it?
Right.
So in the immediacy of the, you know, aftermath of a crisis, those aren't necessarily like forefront thoughts people are thinking, mm-hmm. but they're right. bearing the weight of that, even if it hasn't come to consciousness quite yeah. yet. That's part of kind of teasing out, gosh, what, like, why am I wrestling with all of these yeah. things? Or what yeah. is the weight of this experience?
And certainly it must be named that there are those that have lost loved ones. Life has been lost. And here in Western North Carolina in the aftermath of Helene, you know, that over 100 people died and some still missing. So there's obviously also that grieving the loss of life that might not be most people who experience the disaster, their story, but it's certainly woven into this narrative in a really important way too, that needs to be named.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think people who are either in part of the community, you know, they're grieving that loss as well. I mean, this is still mm-hmm. somebody that they had a relationship with. And then there's people that are outside the community that are watching this happening who are putting themselves in those shoes and going, gosh, like, how would I feel if that was my family member? Mm-hmm. And they're experiencing a level of grief as yeah. well,
yeah.
Kind of looking from the outside in.
Yeah. So I've got to ask you, Josie, because you actually spent some time as a firefighter and created a chaplain corps in Colorado to support fellow fighters, you and your husband, Scott, who's also a dear friend of mine. I want to know, just from your perspective, based on that experience, what has this whole thing been like for those firefighters on the front lines? I mean, I think a lot of people, I see so many people posting from that area, how much they appreciate the work and the efforts of those firefighters. What might this be like for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as first responders, and you know, certainly firefighters are on the front lines, but there's others that are supporting, you know, medical responders, police as well. You know, you get very skilled at compartmentalizing, and so setting aside what you might be feeling in the moment to get the job done, to press into what's being demanded of you in the moment. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. the reality is, particularly for LA Fire Department, these firefighters are also deeply impacted. This is their mm-hmm. community. This might be their homes. This might be yeah. people that they knew that yeah. have died. And you know, when we set up our chaplaincy corps in Northeastern Colorado and we're part of that fire department, it was a very small integrated community. And so any event sent deep ripples through the first responders that were on scene. And so we've really just seen this firsthand. And unfortunately, you get so skilled at compartmentalizing that you often forget that you've got to return to those mm-hmm. events and process them yeah. out. So, you know, they're going to be going through their own levels of a kind of holistic response, you know, certainly physical exhaustion at this point. And thankfully there's additional teams that are coming into support from, you know, literally other countries, certainly throughout the United States and then Canada and Mexico. I just saw a South African fire department team mm-hmm. landed to come to support. And that's huge. There's a sense of encouragement and, mm-hmm. and energy that comes anytime a new team hits the ground, and
yeah.
that can really kind of help bolster and keep, you know, the firefighters going. But they're going through their own grief and loss, yeah. their own sense of impact, and recognition of what this is going to mean for their communities at a deeper level than the support firefighters are going to know.
Yeah.
So yes, I'm circling back around to the things that they have tucked away
mm-hmm.
in order to get the job done is just so necessary, because those things are going to pop up in the future. And yeah. if they're not processed in restorative ways, they're going to pop up in usually pretty messy ways that deeply impact relationships and kind of sense of self and identity. So thankfully, we've seen a good development of crisis care for first responders over the past 20 or 30 years, specifically in the United States. And that's been a gift to see that be developed.
Yeah. So Josie, shifting gears a little bit here, you know, we live in this age where all of us, whether we're in, you know, the outskirts of LA or here in Boone, North Carolina, or in Scotland for you, we can watch this disaster unfold live. You know, we can watch the news of a war, a famine, an earthquake, anything basically unfold live on our phones, on our televisions. And so we're all experiencing, I think, this disaster in some way. What would you say the benefits of that accessibility, that mental proximity are? What are some of the merits of it? And what are some of the costs? Like, how can we appropriately manage our attention and our energy when there is no limit to the amount of suffering that we are able to witness these days?
Yeah, I'm so glad you raised this point, because it is something I don't think we talk often enough about. And that really is the more so that at any other time in the history of humanity, we do have access to information. You know, the human psyche and kind of emotional capacity really maxes out at about 100 relationships. You know, that's kind of how we're wired to engage with the world around us. And ironically enough, that's about the average size of a village, you know, a couple hundred years ago. Like, that's just where we max out. And, you know, our definitions of neighborhood and community have shifted in such significant ways in the past 20 or 30 years. You know, it used to be that our neighborhood and our community were also in physical proximity to us. So now we're in a situation where our neighborhood may not be our community. Our neighborhood is our physical proximity, but our community could be all around the world. And really, at an emotional and psychological level, you're more likely to be deeply impacted by a crisis or disaster if you have a personal connection to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, back before we had access to all this information and capability of travel and, you know, kind of more of this globally connected life, we were more personally connected to things in our physical proximity. Well, now we can be personally connected to something on the other side of the world.
Right.
So when a crisis happens there, if you visited, it's going to rise higher in your level of consciousness. If you have people that you know that are still there, even higher still. If you've lived there, then, you know, kind of at its highest level, you've got memories tied to that kind of place. So when we're exposed to all of this kind of global suffering, our brain is trying to put everything in context. So it'll sort and prioritize what we take in. But there's also this reality that we're taking in so much information that our brain's really like, I don't know what to do with all of this. And I'm going to actually shut down some of these things, because capacity is tapped out here. And so your ability then to be able to respond empathetically, compassionately, practically, can be really significantly compromised by the amount of information that you take in. So the benefits to this, if we can say that, you know, the reality that our brains really haven't developed enough to be able to handle everything that we're allowing it access to. In the meantime, the benefit is that it can spur us to practical action. You know, there are people for Hurricane Helene, for example, that responded from all around the world, whether they sent in cash donations, whether they physically responded by giving volunteer hours, whether they sent in supplies.
It felt truly miraculous. I want to say, from having been here, it was like the number of people that I saw posting from all over the world, and just the amount of stuff and money that just, you know, we could not have shouldered this on our own. You know, our communities could not have managed it without all that attention and without all that that just outpouring of shared grief and care, you know, mm-hmm. so that really mattered.
And that makes a transformative difference. You know, I mean, it's mm-hmm. not like crises are new to our, you know, season mm-hmm. of history. You know, crises have been happening at a global scale for the history of humanity, and entire communities have been wiped out because mm-hmm. they didn't have any kind of extended support. They didn't have those kinds of resources flowing yeah. in from all other areas that weren't affected. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, kind of the benefit of the information age, is that we do have then the capacity to go, I had no idea this was happening over there. What can I do? And mm-hmm. and then we can respond. The drawback is we can get numbed to these mm-hmm. things, mm-hmm. and we can kind of fall into this, again, this category where our brain's like, I can't handle any more mm-hmm. of this, and I just got to shut it off. Mm-hmm. And that might not be a tangible decision we're making.
Right.
Just our physiological system saying, no more. This is sensory overload. And so, you know, then we can kind of wrestle with maybe even a little bit of self-blame of like, why mm-hmm. why don't I feel more intensely about these things?
Right.
And it's really just that your whole system's going, I can't take it anymore. I got to restore and recover.
Right. There are terms like, people use disaster fatigue, crisis fatigue. It's like if you've been watching what's unfolding in Gaza and you've been watching the impacts of the multiple hurricanes that impacted the coast and inland this year, and now we're seeing this in LA. I wonder too if there does feel like there's this deeper connection in LA, because so many people have visited LA. It's a tourist spot. That's why a lot of people responded to the mountains, is because the mountains was this place that everyone on the East Coast would come for respite and for their family memories that were made in this space. And so people felt a connection. We're seeing, I mean, celebrities that we have these parasocial relationships now, right? Like I don't know Jennifer Garner, but like I've seen her in a lot of movies, and now I'm seeing her on the news, and I feel this strange connection with her just because I know who she is. So suddenly we're seeing these familiar faces of people that have lost their home. And I think that that is part of what's pulling people towards this particular crisis. Does that make sense?
No, I 100% agree. That aspect of social media kind of inviting this inch deep personal relationship. Mm-hmm. So you really do feel like you know somebody more than, you know, you otherwise would if it was just a, you know, newspaper story about mm-hmm. someone. But we've gotten these invitations into other people's lives. And so then when something does happen, you know, there's kind of interesting research surrounding grief over the death of a famous person. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you know, where people don't know this individual. And, you know, a lot of those articles came out in the UK after the death of the Queen, and just mm-hmm. how impactful that was for the entire nation, because they never knew this person, never had a relationship with her, but there was this sense of knowing, and it is that sense of knowing that drives kind of that personal impact and can increase the risk of vicarious trauma.
So in a world of parasocial relationships, of these digital connections, of really frankly being pulled to the far corners of the world by our phones, I share this Wendell Berry quote all the time. anyone who listens to this podcast or reads my newsletter or follows me on social media is like, okay, enough with that quote, Amanda, we've heard it a million times. But he says, no matter how much one may love the world as a whole, one can live fully in it only by living responsibly in some small part of it. Where we live and who we live with there define the terms of our relationship to the world and to humanity. And so one of those drawbacks of, you know, having all this crisis exposure from around the world is that it sometimes draws our attention away from our proximate community and the people that are actually within arm's length of us. And we disengage from those communities and are more engaged online. And again, there's a balance to understanding why I'd love for my generosity to reach these people far away that are in great need, but not at the cost of loving my actual neighbor, you know? Yeah. And sometimes we do that.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, in many ways, it feels easier. It feels easier mm-hmm. to respond to something that's an arm's length away. There's less vulnerability, less risk mm-hmm. involved. Mm-hmm.
but less required of you in many ways.
Yeah, you can, with a click of a button, you know, you get kind of that altruistic hit of, oh, mm-hmm. I did something.
Yeah. And I want people to do that. Click the button, give money. Yes. But also...
This really falls so heavily in what we call the yes and category. So, mm-hmm. Often we fall in the I can do this, but not that, and mm-hmm. and emphasizing the yes and. You can do this and this other thing. So you can reach out and support something that's halfway around the world that's not in your physical proximity. Mm-hmm. And you can take a look at, what are the things I can do in my practical proximity?
Yeah.
Where are the resources that are in my community that might need a similar level of support? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a cash donation. Maybe it's volunteer man hours. Maybe it's a family down the street. Yeah. I didn't realize I was struggling, but now I've been made aware that some extra just presence might mm-hmm. be really restorative for them. And those are things I can do. So always assessing things through that yes mm-hmm. and. It's easier to put it in the binary this or that category.
Yeah.
But the reality is it's that yes and piece. And I love that Wendell Berry quote. I just love Wendell Berry in general. But that is that emphasis that those relationships in our physical proximity are necessary.
Yeah.
And we're going through a cultural shift in our society, our global society, where we have access to relationships that are not in our physical proximity. So both really have to be true. They have to come through.
Yeah. So let's talk about this yes and, because another thing I'm seeing online, I really need to not be online, Josie, because it just gets me all worked up. I know, yes and. Okay. But a lot of what I'm seeing is the whataboutisms, so it's like, okay, well, you're all worried about these Malibu estates, these Malibu mansions burning, but what about the children in Gaza? What about, and I'm seeing this a lot even from my own neighbors in my own community, and I get a little emotional talking about, well, what about us in Western North Carolina? There are still 70,000 people who, their homes are destroyed or damaged, so much displacement, homelessness. There's this question of, are people more drawn into watching a mansion burn versus a trailer home floating down the river? And what types of people are more deserving of our compassion? So what is it in us that feels this need to compare or, say like, well, if you care about these people, don't you care about these people, or don't worry about them, they're fine. What about this vulnerable group or that vulnerable group? Why are we doing this online right now?
Honestly, it is our whole system working to put things in context. Mm-hmm. And, we sort and we prioritize. And, mm-hmm. and that is how our brain resolves these crises that do feel overwhelming. And like, mm-hmm. gosh, I feel so powerless. Like there's nothing that I can do about, this situation over there. And so we do kind of, again, it becomes kind of this quick hit of response. Where people feel like if I'm advocating in this category, that means I'm doing something. Yeah. The problem is when things contribute to division, when they fall in that category of contextualization, that's kind of in that blame category, or people lash out with anger, then honestly, we're interrupting our own healing. We really are stopping ourselves from being able to process these experiences in restorative ways. And we're contributing to the disintegration of the community that receives our communications, whether that's an online community or a community in our physical proximity. Because the reality is, we can care about the situation in Gaza. We can care about the situation that's ongoing in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, not the least of which is one of the harshest winters in North Carolina, tri-state's history, and people who are without power and heat still are, living and trying to survive in tents or, glamping pods. So we can care about all of those things, and we can't care about all of those things at the same level. We just can't. But what we can do is ask ourselves, what can I practically do today? What's the next best restorative action I can take? And the whataboutisms and the blame and the lashing out is not a restorative action. That's going to interrupt my own healing. It's going to contribute to the disintegration of community. Now, that's not to say, I want to give this quick caveat, that accountability is not important. So there's a big difference between blame and accountability. Accountability is approaching a situation with curiosity to understand what mistakes were made, what kind of, honestly, what justice needs to happen there, and then how can lessons be learned to move forward. Blame is always a looking back, you know, divisive action, but accountability can actually contribute towards restoration. So that's not to say that accountability is taken off the table, but what it is to say is, how can we ask ourselves, what's restorative in my immediate proximity? What action can I take to contribute towards the restoration of this affected community that I do care about? And what can I do right now to move that forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of that makes great sense. And I think what is coming to my mind is this sense that we often approach empathy or love or care with this kind of presiding narrative of lack, as if that, like, compassion is this, like, a pie, and we're all competing for the piece of the pie, and suffering's like this zero-sum game where we're comparing whose suffering is the worst and who's more deserving of care and compassion. And while I do believe we as individuals have limits in terms of what we're able to do, what we're able to hold, there is something in me, and this may be my faith, my spirituality, that speaks to this, it believes that there's a limitlessness to love, to collective love in some degree. There's something about empathy that has this limitless quality. And that's partly because I believe that God is love and God is limitless. And again, it's not that that means I have to care and give my attention to every war, every famine, Myanmar, DRC, Sudan, the list goes on and on. But rather, it's to say, I believe that we as a whole, as humanity, empowered by the love of God, can actually meet these needs, can shoulder this together. But that is not how we talk on the internet.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And you know, definitely that's such a great point to bring out for clarity, is that how we respond empathetically, you're absolutely right. There's no limit to that. We can care about all these things, and we can't shoulder the weight of yes. all of these things. So when we see those news articles pop up, when we see that that situation be shared, we can respond in an empathetic way that doesn't have a limit. And we can connect with others in our community to respond in empathetic ways. And that amplifies our mm-hmm. ability to respond because energy generates energy, compassion and empathy generates compassion and empathy. So I 100% agree. I think we struggle a lot with a scarcity mindset, and I think these crises tend to emphasize that. And there's a, you know, variety, a host of reasons why that happens. There's various even systemic kind of society constructs that contribute to a sense of scarcity and lack. When you express a need and that need is not met, that feeds into that. But then identifying where those restorative actions have happened and responding with gratitude, celebrating those restorative actions, those are all things that can combat that sense of scarcity.
Right.
Is when we can kind of call that out, and we can take that action on our own when we start to see those whataboutisms and just express that gratitude and express that celebration for what has happened up to that point.
Yeah. Well, and we all need a sense of permission to lay things down sometimes too. And I'm speaking directly maybe to people in the greater LA area. I have some friends that live there whose their homes have not burned and they've not quite yet been evacuated. They're waiting, watching, but they're feeling the sense of the same thing I did after Helene happened. My home was totally fine. You know, we were displaced for a couple of weeks because we didn't have power and water, but like, we fared so well. So many of our neighbors did not. And there was this constant sense of, I should be doing something. I should be doing something. I should be acting. I should be serving. I should be giving. And it is okay to stop doom scrolling. I mean, that was another thing a lot of my friends were doing here, is we spent whatever we weren't out helping, we were scrolling on our phones, just kind of obsessively ingesting the disaster because it felt like we needed to stay close to it if we cared. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it is okay if you are a resident of LA and you need to go for, you know, take a minute and turn your phone off, turn the TV off and have a cup of tea or play with your kids or enjoy your spouse, like whatever it is that you need to do. My counselor recently said to me, I have this thing in my life that I worry about a lot. And she's like, you know, we talked about the box, you know, I'm sure Josie, you know, the box, probably a lot of our listeners know the box. You put it in a box and you put it away for a time being. And she said, putting it in a box is not saying, well, I don't care about this right now. It's actually caretaking it. Mm-hmm. It's actually saving your energy so that when the moment comes where there's something you do need to address around that thing, when there's something you do need to do, some action you do need to take, you have the energy and the stability of mind to do that well. And so putting this disaster, whatever disaster it is that's going on in the world that you care about, you feel compared to care about, it's okay to put it in a box for extended periods of time and restore so that you can respond in a way that brings life and energy to you and to the person who needs your help.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I mean, when our community went through Hurricane Ian and our little section of Southwest mm-hmm. Florida was totally wiped out, my husband and I and several team members had been spending weeks in medical care and response and water distribution. And just about every night we went down to the beach and walked mm-hmm. the beach because yeah. we needed to take that time to refuel, to restore ourselves. And sometimes that verbiage can be tied to so I can respond more effectively. Mm-hmm. And that kind of puts us a little bit into that temptation of productivity.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I want to emphasize that it's okay to just go, actually, I just need to renew.
Right.
I may not be able to give out more, but this yeah. is what I need to right, heal right. and to restore and to recover. And if I can give out more down the road, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, that's a
but
good
I'm
word.
Not
yeah.
doing this so that I can do that. But the, you know, the doom scrolling, the information gathering, there's a couple of reasons why that happens. First of all, again, our brain is trying to put things in context. And the way that we, since we were teeny tiny, have been kind of trained to do that is through information. You know, mm-hmm. we assess information and then we process and prioritize and put things into context. So if the more insecure a situation feels, the more information we're going to feel like mm-hmm. we need to gather. Mm-hmm. And that happens through scrolling mm-hmm. social media and finding all the news sites and joining all the Reddit forums and, you mm-hmm. know, whatever it is that we're getting our information from. But that it also steals energy from the future. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so your advice from your counselor is exactly right in that by obsessing about it now, you are potentially inhibiting your ability to restoratively respond down the road. It's not tied to it. It's not a formula, but you're using some of that energy now when it's not even needed. Yeah. And I love that tangible picture of putting things on the shelf. When we talk about compartmentalizing things mm-hmm. so you can get done in the moment what you need to get done,
yeah.
that tangible image and that tangible action can be really helpful for people in being yeah. able to set things aside. And again, remembering that it's so important to revisit those things in restorative ways.
Yeah.
So that they don't come back in divisive or disintegrative ways.
Yeah. They? Well, and I think what I'm hearing you say again and again is this idea. We are kind of, our brains like to organize information. We are, I've heard people say we are meaning making creatures. Yeah. And I wonder sometimes too, if this kind of impulse to blame, like that's another thing that I'm seeing online a lot right now too, is like, whose fault is this fire? Is it that they, you know, cut funding to whatever emergency services? Is it the wealthy? Is it climate change? Is it politicians that have let climate change get so bad? You know, a lot of feelings about like funding coming into North Carolina versus promises made to the LA, just so much. We want to name a perpetrator, you know, and I think a lot of that in some ways too may be just an act of agency. Like if I can figure out what the cause is, if I can figure out why this happened, then we can mitigate it and stop it from happening to me again. You know, so it is both that the internet craves rage, that the algorithm is inclined towards anger and blame and enemies and enemy making, and also our own just human, long before the internet, our own human propensity to want to find a reason and name the chain of events that led up to this so that we don't have to experience this again. So in some ways, it's like, I have some empathy towards the rage as well. I have some empathy towards the blaming. And also, I just want to check that in myself. And I want to make space for, yes, we got to interrogate this. Of course, we got to interrogate climate change. Of course, we need to. I think it's a valid question at some point to say, how do people process, you know, rural disasters versus urban disasters? And when disasters happen to the wealthy versus when disasters happen to the economically disadvantaged, all of these things are worth asking the question. But what's happening right now feels like this just churn of blame and unhealthy coping mm-hmm. on the internet, if that makes mm-hmm. sense.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly what it is. It is our whole system working to make sense of what's going on. Because we do feel like, whether we consciously think this or not, that if we can make sense of it, then there's, in some way, we can almost kind of set it aside. It's like our brain mm-hmm. can resolve it.
Yeah.
But as long as it's in this ambiguous space, it is kind of creating this internal energy. And the blame and the rage kind of gives this quick hit, quick outlet for that energy. Mm-hmm. And that quick hit and quick outlet makes us momentarily feel better.
Right. So
it kind of is a self-perpetuating cycle because we feel good when we lash out because we kind of get this release of all this pent up angst about what's happening and not necessarily what's happening out there. But again, because we kind of feel this personal connection, it really does kind of feel like it's bringing it home more. And then even more so if it is actually happening in our own backyard and to our own backyard. So that lashing out it's a disintegrative way of releasing all of this energy that we have inside. And when we can kind of identify more effectively the holistic impact of these kinds of events at that body, mind, heart, and soul level, you know, we only kind of briefly touched on the physical side earlier, but the mind, heart, and soul piece, and start to notice what's happening in ourselves and name those things. That's a restorative way to release that kind of anxiety and kind of internal churn. And that's a way that we can care for ourselves in the moment, mm-hmm. but then also potentially act in more restorative ways towards our community, which speeds up community recovery. Mm-hmm. I think that's a challenge with the blame, shame kind of rage cycle is that contributes to, disintegration. I mean, mm-hmm, that inhibits mm-hmm. resilience, inhibits recovery. And I mean, we don't, you know, at levels that we're not really realizing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my last question for you kind of, I think, piggybacks well onto that is, you know, we're talking about maybe healthier ways to respond. Are there ways that communities, individuals can be prepared for these disasters? Because here you and I are sitting here, you've been through a hurricane with your community and probably other things. I'm sure if we talked about all the things we've experienced in our life, you know, we've just experienced a hurricane in our community. It does seem like maybe these climate related disasters are going to become more and more a part of daily life. You know, how can we be prepared? And I'm not necessarily talking about from like a civic, like what does the local government need to do to get ready? But I'm kind of talking about us as individuals and family units and maybe church community units. What can we do to be prepared?
Mm-hmm. Well, identifying the need to be prepared is honestly mm-hmm. the first step. It's just so tempting to fall into a reactionary cycle because there are other things that feel more pressing. But the reality is no time spent planning is ever wasted. So when you can kind of consider what are the gaps in our community? Where do we need to develop relationship? You know, we talked earlier a bit about kind of those four key aspects of human relationship that mm-hmm. are core to resilience, and that relationship with self, relationship with divine or sacred or God or however it's named for you in your faith and spirituality, relationship with your community, and relationship with the natural world. And when we have the opportunity to take some time as a family, as a community, and go, what is the status of these relationships? We know that relationship is core to resilient recovery. Are there gaps that we need to fill? Are there things that we need to be intentional about developing? So if something happened in our own backyard, we could come together in restorative ways and respond. And, you know, you're exactly right. There's tremendous amount of resources to talk about preparedness at the government level, you know, the ways that you need to have different resources stashed up. And there's systemic societal structures that prevent that from happening in many communities where that's just not possible. Yeah. So identifying maybe where even some of those gaps might be, knowing yourself, you know, knowing where you're at in your kind of journey of resilience, journey towards wholeness. Where our organization has a journal that we've just released called Pursuing Wholeness. And it's really an assessment workbook that kind of takes you through at a body, mind, heart, and soul, an evaluation of these four key relationships and kind of considering at a practical level, what is available to me? What does need to be developed for down the road? And it's not a matter of if crisis is going to happen in your community. It's a matter of when. We kind of fall into this temptation that crises are out there, wherever out there is. It's just not here in my backyard until it does happen in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And then it's really clear where the gaps are. But what we continue to advocate for is that identification and assessment can happen prior. And when it does, communities more effectively recover. They just do. The research demonstrates it over and over and over again. And so much of that depends on wholeness and relationships in those four categories.
Josie, that's such a good word that you've offered. Thank you so much for your wisdom and your insight. Can you tell people a little bit about where they might find you, what your organization has to offer before we say goodbye?
Sure. Happy to. So the Resilience Resource can be found at theresilienceresource.org. We also have a UK website. If you've got listeners that are coming in from UK and Europe, and it's just the Resilience
Resource. We do actually. This is a global, my reach is global, Josie.
That's amazing. And,
no, it may be. I have like a couple friends in the UK and around, but whatever that map populates on my distribution analytics, I'm like, oh, look at that. That makes me feel important. But anyway, yeah. So we do actually have some listeners in the UK.
Well, there you go. So it's the same website, theresilienceresource.org. You just end. And certainly there's loads more information there. We just released, like I mentioned earlier, this field guide for survivor center care. And it's available on Amazon and on our website. And it's specifically intended to be a quick reference guide for someone who's like, I'm going into a situation, I need some practical tools. How do I identify kind of stress signs and symptoms or trauma signs and symptoms? What would it look like to help to calm a distressed individual, to help to stabilize them? You know, how can I connect them with additional resources? And it's global in scope. So there's emergency numbers for other countries. There's some reference lists to resources in other spaces. So that's a good option to check out. We also, if people are interested in becoming more equipped to help their communities and to help their communities prepare, we do a 2.5-day training called Compassionate Care in Crisis. We have two dates in the UK in May and November in beautiful Edinburgh, Scotland. So you can combine it with a trip to explore this amazing country if you'd like. And then a date that will be announced soon in the US in July. So people can check that out as well. And then the Pursuing Wholeness Journal is also available with the field guide for survivor-centered care on Amazon. So our org really works to help organizations, individuals, communities prepare for these kinds of events, talk through procedures, even policies of holistic people care, holistic people support and resilience building. we come alongside in the midst of a crisis that might be ongoing and help to provide some practical tools. Our team ranges from crisis care responders, from chaplains to pastors to psychological first aid instructors. So we have the opportunity to support or the ability to support people from a range of experiences and backgrounds. And then we provide post-crisis care and a clinical mental health referral list for when maybe the needs of support are beyond the capacity of the community, the family, or our team. So, yeah.
Well, Josie, this has been helpful for me just to talk with you as I'm processing what I'm seeing, processing what we've experienced as a community in the last 4 months. Thank you so much for offering your time and your wisdom. It's great to connect with you again. And our thoughts, our prayers are going out towards the people who are struggling in LA right now. So thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Josie for the conversation.
It's been a privilege to be on with you today, Amanda. Thanks again.